France as it became clear that the Germans were using their plants to help coordinate submarine and battleship movements. The wireless lines also marked the burgeoning alliance forming between Italy and the British Empire. As a pacifist, Wilson maintained a strict policy of neutrality, a position bolstered by war hero and former President Teddy Roosevelt, himself a contender for the upcoming 1916 election. Although officially neutral, the sentiments of the majority of the American population was with England, particularly after Germany stormed through the peaceful Kingdom of Belgium. Nevertheless, fully one-tenth of the population was of German stock, and their sentiments were with the other side. George Sylvester Viereck, the country's leading poet, colleague of Johnson and Tesla's friend, began to sense the growing shift away from neutrality, especially after the U.S. Navy appropriated the Tuckerton plant to send its own radio-coded messages abroad. Having just returned from Berlin and the midst of war, Viereck courted Teddy Roosevelt and emissaries of President Wilson. Simultaneously, he began a new publication with other leading German Americans. Initially welcomed by the press, The Fatherland soon achieved a subscription base of 100,000. Ignoring Viereck's plea for neutrality, Wilson prepared a presidential decree, declaring that all radio stations within the jurisdiction of the United States of America were to be prohibited from transmitting or receiving messages of an unneutral nature. "By virtue of authority vested in me by the Radio Act," the president continued, "one or more of the high-powered radio stations within the jurisdiction of the United States shall be taken over by the government." Throughout the beginning of the war, Tesla stepped up his legal campaign against Marconi and continued to advise and receive compensation from Telefunken. Since the country was officially neutral, America would not enter the war for another 3 years, the arrangement was entirely above board. Nevertheless, few people knew about the German-Tesla link, although the inventor made no secret of it to Jack Morgan. February the 19th, 1915. "Dear Mr. Morgan, I am expecting to embody in their plant at Saville some features of my own which will make it practicable to communicate with Berlin by wireless telephone, and then royalties will be very considerable. We have already drawn papers." Camouflaged by the smokescreen of the American-sounding Atlantic Communication Company, Telefunken swiftly moved to increase the power of its remaining station at Saville. Located near the town of Patchogue, out on the flats of Long Island, just a few miles from Wardenclyffe, the Saville complex encompassed 100 acres and employed many German workers. With its main offices in Manhattan and its German director, Dr. Carl George Frank, an American citizen, Telefunken was legally covered, for no foreigner could own a license to operate a wireless station in the country. Thus, Marconi also had an American affiliate. It was an easy matter for Tesla to confer with Atlantic in the city and also go out to the site of the plant. Within 2 months of Tesla's letter to Morgan, the plant at Saville tripled its output by erecting two more pyramid-shaped transmission towers 500 feet tall. Utilizing Tesla's theories on the importance of ground transmission, resonating accoutrements spread out over the land for thousands of more feet. Thus, by shifting emphasis away from aerial transmission, Telefunken's output was boosted from 35 kilowatts to over 100, catapulting Germany into the number one spot in the wireless race. The New York Times reported on their front page, "Few persons outside radio officials knew that Saville was becoming one of the most powerful transatlantic communicating stations in this part of the world." Tesla sues Marconi on wireless plant. Alleges that important apparatus infringes prior rights. Calling wireless the greatest of all inventions, Tesla made an additional appeal for legal assistance to Morgan. "Can you put yourself for a moment in my place?" he wrote the financier. "Surely you are too big a man to permit such an outrage and historical crime to be perpetuated as is now being done by cunning promoters. Expecting to receive satisfaction from the government since they had installed $10 million of his apparatus," the inventor also revealed that The Marconi people approach me to join forces, but only in stock, and this is not acceptable. Again, Morgan declined assistance in protecting their patents held in common. The Wall Street mogul, however, had not at all abandoned the field, for he was funding a college radio station near Boston at Tufts University. The years preceding America's entrance into World War I contained an overwhelming quagmire of litigation, involving most countries and virtually every major inventor in the wireless field. At about the time of Tesla's breakup with Hammond, Fritz Lowenstein, who was paying royalties to both men and to Morgan through Tesla, began installing wireless apparatus aboard Navy ships. Although the equipment was also being used by Hammond to test the guided missiles, this work was classified, and Hammond's patents became immune from litigation. Aside from Tesla's priority battle, Telefunken was also suing Marconi, who in turn was suing the U.S. Navy, as well as Fritz Lowenstein, for patent infringement. During the following spring, Marconi was subpoenaed by Telefunken. Due to the importance of the case, he sailed off for America on the Lusitania, arriving in April 1915 to testify. "We sighted a German submarine periscope," he told astonished reporters and his friends at dockside. As three merchant ships had already been torpedoed without warning by the German U-boats the month before, Marconi's inflammatory assertion was not taken lightly. The Brooklyn Eagle reported that this suit brought some of the world's greatest inventors on hand to testify. Declared a victor in the Lowenstein proceedings by a Brooklyn District Court judge, Marconi clearly had the press behind him. Nevertheless, he was beaten by the Navy in his first go-around with them, so this case against Telefunken, with all the heavyweights in town, promised to be portentous. Once and for all, it appeared, the true legal rights would be established in America. Aside from Marconi, there was, for the defense, Columbia professor Mikhail Pupin, whose testimony was even quoted in papers in California. With braggadocio, Pupin declared, "I invented wireless before Marconi or Tesla, and it was I who gave it unreservedly to those who followed." Nevertheless, Pupin continued, "It was Marconi's genius who gave the idea to the world, and he taught the world how to build the telegraphic practice upon the basis of this idea. As I did not take out patents on my experiments, in my opinion, the first claim for wireless telegraphy belongs to Mr. Marconi absolutely, and to nobody else." Watching his fellow serb upon the stand, Tesla's jaw dropped so hard it almost cracked upon the floor. When Tesla took the stand for Atlantic, he came with his attorney, Drury W. Cooper, of Kerr, Page & Cooper. Unlike Pupin, who could only state abstractly that he was the original inventor, Tesla proceeded to explain in clear fashion all of his work from the years 1891 to 1899. He documented his assertions with transcripts from published articles, from the Martin text, and from public lectures, such as his well-known wireless demonstration, which he had presented to the public in St. Louis in 1893. The inventor also brought along copies of his various requisite patents, which he had created while working at his Houston Street lab during the years 1896 to 99. Court. "What were the greatest distances between the transmitting and receiving stations?" Tesla. "From the Houston laboratory to West Point, that is, I think, a distance of about 30 miles. Court. "Was that prior to 1901? Tesla. "Yes, it was prior to 1897. Court. "Was there anything hidden about the uses of your equipment, or were they open so that anyone could use them? Tesla. "There were thousands of people, distinguished men of all kinds, from kings and greatest artists and scientists in the world down to old chums of mine, mechanics, to whom my laboratory was always open. I showed it to everybody. I talked freely about it." As virtually no one knew about the West Point experiment, this statement was somewhat deceptive, although it was true that thousands of people had witnessed Tesla's other wireless experiments, such as in St. Louis in 1893. Referring explicitly to Marconi's system, having brought the Italian's patent along with his own, the inventor concluded, "Tesla, If you examine these two diagrams, you will find that absolutely not a vestige of that apparatus of Marconi remains, and that in all the present systems there is nothing but my four tuned circuits. Another jolt to Marconi came from John Stone Stone. His mother's maiden name, by coincidence, was also Stone. Having travelled with his father, a general in the Union Army, throughout Egypt and the Mediterranean as a boy, Stone was educated as a physicist at Columbia University and Johns Hopkins University, where he graduated in 1890. A research scientist for Bell Labs in Boston for many years, Stone had set up his own wireless concern in 1899. The following year, he filed for a fundamental patent on tuning, which was allowed by the U.S. Patent Office over a year before Marconi's. Stone, who never considered himself the original inventor of the radio, as president of the Institute of Radio Engineers and owner of a wireless enterprise, put together a dossier of inventor priorities in continuous wave radio frequency apparatus. He wanted to determine for himself the etiology of the invention. Adorned in a formal suit, silk ascot, high-starched collar, and pince-nez attached by a ribbon to his neck, the worldly aristocrat took the stand. Marconi, receiving his inspiration from Hertz and Righi, was impressed with the electric radiation aspect of the subject, and it was a long time before he seemed to appreciate the real role of the Earth, though he early recognized that the connection of his oscillator to the Earth was of very material value. Tesla's electric earth waves explanation was the more serviceable in that it explained how the waves were enabled to travel over and around hills and were not obstructed by the sphericity of the Earth's surface, while Marconi's view led many to place an altogether too limited scope to the possible range of transmission. With the removal of the spark gap from the antenna, the development of earthed antenna, and the gradual enlargement of the size of stations, greater range could be obtained with larger power used at lower frequencies, and the art returned to the state to which Tesla developed it. Attributing the opposition, and alas even himself, to having been afflicted with intellectual myopia, Stone concluded that although he had been designing wireless equipment and running wireless companies since the turn of the century, it wasn't until he commenced with this study that he really understood Tesla's trailblazing contribution to the development of the field. "I think we all misunderstood Tesla," Stone concluded. "He was so far ahead of his time that the best of us mistook him for a dreamer." Another case, which did not receive much publicity, but which became vital to the Supreme Court's 1943 ruling in Tesla's favor, was Marconi versus U.S. Navy, brought July the 29th, 1916, 2 years after their first go-around. The Italian was seeking $43,000 in damages, suing for infringement of fundamental wireless patent number 763,772, which had been allowed in June 1904. E.F. Sweet, acting Secretary of the Navy and also Assistant Secretary Franklin D. Roosevelt, began a correspondence in September to review Tesla's 1899 file to the Lighthouse Board. The history of Marconi's patent applications to the U.S. Patent Office provided additional ammunition. In 1900, John Seymour, the Commissioner of Patents, who had protected Tesla against the demands of Mikhail Pupin for an AC claim at the same time, disqualified Marconi's first attempts at achieving a patent because of prior claims of Lodge and Brown, and particularly Tesla. Marconi's pretended ignorance of the nature of a Tesla oscillator is little short of absurd, wrote the commissioner. Ever since Tesla's famous 1891-93 lectures, widely published in all languages, the term Tesla oscillator has become a household word on both continents. The Patent Office also cited quotations from Marconi himself, admitting use of a Tesla oscillator. 2 years later, in 1902, Stone was granted his patent on tuning, which the government cited as anticipating Marconi, and 2 years after that, after Seymour retired, Marconi was granted his infamous 1904 patent. Edwin Armstrong. "I have had a lot of fun at Columbia," Armstrong said. The lecturer in physics that semester loftily disparaged the experiments of Nikola Tesla. He even went so far as to say that there was very little originality about Tesla. Ever the audacious student, Armstrong used the professor's ignorance of Tesla's teachings to cause the man to receive a hearty shock from some electrical equipment. He couldn't let go and pulled most of the apparatus off the table before the current was turned off. Just after graduation, Armstrong invented a feedback amplifier, which was, in essence, a refinement and further development of DeForest's Audion tube. Influenced by the Edison effect, or flow of electrons studied by Tesla in the early 1890s in his brush vacuum tube, Armstrong had discovered a way to take the DeForest Audion and amplify its sensitivity and boost its power to another magnitude by connecting a second circuit, or wing circuit, to the grid inside the tube and feeding it back into the grid. The end result was that with this new invention, the young whippersnapper could pick up wireless messages from Nova Scotia, Ireland, Germany, San Francisco, and even Honolulu. As Armstrong was one of Professor Pupin's star pupils, Pupin was able to set up meetings with Lee DeForest, David Sarnoff, representing Marconi Wireless, and Dr. Carl Frank, head of the Atlantic Communication Company. Since DeForest's Audion lay at the center of the new device, DeForest claimed the Ultra Audion as his own invention, so Marconi Wireless stepped aside to wait for the dust to settle. Frank, on the other hand, had Armstrong put the equipment into the wireless plant at Sayville and paid him a royalty of $100 per month. Destined to invent AM and FM radio and a nonconformist by nature, this new wizard on the block had come upon his 1912 discovery because he had rejected the inferior Marconi spark gap apparatus that most of his wireless buddies were still playing with, and, like Stone, plunged himself into the continuous wave technology developed by Tesla. With Professor Pupin training many of the new breed of electrical engineers, it is no wonder that few of them would have the gumption of an Armstrong to see that Marconi's success was based on the work of another, and furthermore, that Marconi succeeded in spite of the fact that he only partially understood what Tesla had attempted. Blinded by the Hertzian spark gap research, Marconi spread his myopic vision through Pupin to the vast hordes of researchers in the field of wireless. And this policy has continued to this day. With Marconi's highly visible early success, large-scale wireless enterprise, and Nobel Prize on his side of the balance, it became much easier to credit him with the discovery. The ongoing Great War served to further cloud the issue, as the important legal battle between Atlantic Cable Company, Telefunken, and Marconi Wireless was abandoned before it was resolved. Due to the dangers that existed on the high seas and the rumors that the Germans were out for Marconi's head, the Senatore did not sail back on the Lusitania. He returned on the St. Paul with a disguised identity and under an assumed name. Marconi set sail as the new head of the AIEE, John S. Stone, was honored at a dinner attended by a potpourri of leaders in the industry. Guests included Lee DeForest, who was about to receive $250,000 for sale of his patents to AT&T, J. A. White, editor of Wireless Magazine, David Sarnoff, on the verge of launching his radio empire, Rudolf Goldschmidt, the force behind the Tuckerton plant, A. E. Kennelly, Fritz Lowenstein, who was about to earn $150,000 from AT&T for one of his inventions, and Nikola Tesla, who stood between DeForest and Lowenstein for an official photograph. A fortnight later, in May 1915, a German submarine torpedoed the Lusitania, killing 1,134 persons. The sinking, in lieu of the alternative procedure of boarding unarmed passenger ships to check cargo, was unheard of. Quite possibly, Marconi could have been a target. However, the Germans used as their reason the cargo of armaments on board headed for Great Britain. With only 750 survivors, this turkey shoot took almost as many lives as the sinking of the Titanic. According to Lloyd Scott of the Navy Consulting Board, press reports stated that the Germans seemed to revel in this crime, and that various celebrations were held in Germany on account of it. Medals were being struck to commemorate the sinking, and holidays were given to schoolchildren. No longer neutral, Teddy Roosevelt hailed the event as murder on the open seas. The huge loss of life, however, did not stop George Sylvester Viereck from supporting the German position. Having travelled by Zeppelin above Berlin during the war, Viereck stated in the New York Times that had the weapons made it to England, more Germans would have been killed than died in the boat attack. Viereck's callous argument inflamed the populace against him. The former renowned poet was now hailed as a venom-bloated toad of treason. The enemy seemed within. German spies were everywhere. Reports started filtering in that the Germans were creating a secret submarine base around islands off the coast of Maine. It was also alleged that the broadcasting station out at Sayville was not merely sending neutral dispatches to Berlin, but also coded messages to battleships and submarines. As Tesla, just a few months earlier, had boasted to Morgan that he was working for the Germans, and with the Times reporting on their front page that Grand Admiral von Tirpitz was contemplating a more vigorous campaign against freight ships and planning a secret base on this side of the Atlantic, it was quite possible that the inventor became tainted with a smattering of venom-bloated toad's blood. On July the 2nd, 1915, the Senate chambers in Washington were rocked by a terrorist bomb. The following day, the fanatic who planted it, Frank Holt, a teacher of German from Cornell University, walked into Jack Morgan's Long Island home, toting a six-gun in each hand. With his wife and daughter leaping at the assailant, Morgan charged forward. Shot twice in the groin, Morgan was able, with the help of his fearsome wife, to wrestle the guns from the man and get him arrested. Recuperating at the hospital, the hero received a get-well letter from Nikola Tesla. When questioned, Holt claimed he had not planned to kill the Wall Street monarch. He only wanted the financier to stop the flow of arms to Europe. A few days later, as Morgan recovered quickly and fired all German and Austrian workers from his office, the self-righteous pacifist committed suicide in his jail cell. His secret had been unveiled. Holt's real name was Dr. Erich Münter. He was a former German teacher from Harvard who had disappeared after murdering his wife with poison in 1906. A week later, on Tesla's 59th birthday, the Times reported that not only were the Germans dropping bombs over London from Zeppelins, they were also controlling air torpedoes by means of radio dynamics. Fired from Zeppelins, the supposed German aerial torpedoes can theoretically remain in the air 3 hours and can be controlled from a distance of 2 miles. Undoubtedly, this is the secret invention of which we have heard so many whispers that the Germans have held in reserve for the British fleet. Although it seemed as if Tesla's devil automata had come into being, as the wizard had predicted a decade before, Tesla himself announced to the press that the news of these magic bombs cannot be accepted as true, though they reveal just so many startling possibilities. Aghast at the pernicious existing regime of the Germans, Tesla accused Germany of being an unfeeling automaton, a diabolic contrivance for scientific, pitiless, wholesale destruction, the like of which was not dreamed of before. Such is the formidable engine Germany has perfected for the protection of her culture and the conquest of the globe. Predicting the ultimate defeat of the fatherland, the Serb, whose former countrymen were fighting for their own survival against the Kaiser, no doubt stopped doing business with von Tirpitz, although he probably continued his relationship with Professor Schlabi, who may have been morally opposed to the war. Tesla's solution to war was twofold: a better defense through an electronic Star Wars type of shield he was working on, and the eradication from our hearts of nationalism. If blind patriotism could be replaced with love of nature and scientific ideal, permanent peace could be established. The period from 1915 to the date of the United States' entry into the war in 1917 was marked by numerous reports of espionage. Spies had infiltrated the Brooklyn Navy Yard to use the station to send secret coded messages to Berlin. Through Richard Funt, head of the Sayville plant, they had also installed equipment on the roof of 111 Broadway, the building that housed Telefunken's offices. Shortly after America's entrance into the war, Tesla informed Scherf that Lieutenant Emil Myers, who ran the Tuckerton operation, had been placed in a detention camp in Georgia, suspected of spying. Thus, the monthly stipend from Telefunken had come to an abrupt end. The Secretary of the Navy, whose job it became to take over all wireless stations, was Josephus Daniels. His assistant was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In the summer of 1915, Daniels, who was actively monitoring Jack Hammond's work, had read a recent interview with Thomas Alva Edison. Impressed with the contents, the secretary called Edison and set up a meeting with the idea of creating an advisory board of inventors. The hope was that should the country go to war, a civilian think tank, much like the one created in Great Britain, could be created. Great Britain's consulting board included J.J. Thomson, W.H. Bragg, Sir William Crookes, Sir Oliver Lodge, and Ernest Rutherford. Edison, who himself had received death threats from the Fifth Column, became president of this naval consultant board. Working with Franklin Roosevelt, Edison appointed numerous inventors to various positions, including Gano Dunn, Reginald Fessenden, Benjamin Lamb, Irving Langmuir, R.A. Millikan, Mikhail Pupin, Charles S. Scott, Elmer Sperry, Frank Sprague, and Elihu Thompson. The journalist Waldemar Kempfert was also included because of his writing prowess. It is possible that Tesla's link to Telefunken was the reason his name was not on the list, although many other inventors were also excluded, for example, Hammond, Stone, and DeForest. Tesla also was not one to work again for Thomas Edison. Tesla's work, however, was obviously vital to the government. With President Wilson allowing his advisor, Colonel William House, to set up a secret fund for Hammond to advance the Tesla inventions, Tesla himself slipped into a more surreptitious realm. 41. The Invisible Audience, 1915 to 1921. Dear Tesla, when that Nobel Prize comes, remember that I'm holding onto my house by the skin of my teeth and desperately in need of cash. No apology for mentioning the matter. Yours faithfully, R.U.J. On November the 6th, 1915, the New York Times published on its front page that Tesla and Edison were to share the Nobel Prize in Physics that year. The source for the report was the Copenhagen correspondent of the London Daily Telegraph. Although Tesla himself forwarded to J.P. Morgan Jr. original copies of the announcement, which were also carried in a number of other journals, neither Tesla nor Edison ever received the Nobel Prize. In trying to ascertain what happened, Tesla biographers Inez Hunt and Juanetta Draper wrote in the early 1960s to Dr. Rudberg of the Royal Academy of Science of Sweden. Rudberg, referring to an event which took place a half-century before, replied, "Any rumor that a person has not been given a Nobel Prize because he has made known his intention to refuse the reward is ridiculous." Thus they concluded that the affair was a sardonic joke. Curiously, this same Times article listed four other people for Nobel Prizes in literature and chemistry who also did not receive the award that year, although three of them eventually obtained it. The fourth, Troll Lund, like Tesla and Edison, never received the honor. Although the announcement came in November 1915, the nomination process actually was concluded 9 months earlier. There were 19 scientists on the physics committee, each allowed two bids. Out of the 38 possible bids, two were made for inventors in wireless, E. Branly and A. Rigi. Two were for the quantum physicist Max Planck, Tom Edison received one bid, and the Braggs took four. According to the Royal Academy's records, Nikola Tesla was not nominated that year. However, two bids, numbers 33 and 34, were missing from their files. A week after the Times announcement, on November the 14th, Stockholm announced that Professor William H. Bragg and his son would share the award in physics. The man who nominated Edison, Henry Fairfield Osborne, president of Columbia University, who 20 years before had awarded Tesla an honorary doctorate, apologized to the committee for offering up Edison's name. "Although somewhat out of the line of previous nominations," Osborne wrote, qualifying his decision, "I would like to suggest the name of Mr. Thomas A. Edison, who is, through his inventions, one of the greatest benefactors of mankind." Tesla would not be nominated until 1937 by F. Ehrenhaft of Wien, who had previously nominated Albert Einstein. Certainly both Tesla and Edison deserved such an award, and it is nothing short of astounding that, one, neither of them ever received it, and two, No one at the time discovered the reason behind this curious quirk of history.